Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Now, it was Phil Leonis, one of our Los Angeles correspondents, who pointed out that whereas in Britain we have Black History Month in October, which is a good 31 days, in the United States of America, Black History Month is obviously February, one of the shortest months. I'm sure there's nothing to that. But at the bottom, at the end of the day, we want to celebrate positivity and all sorts of things. And so we're delighted to actually welcome to the program, again, a terrific person. We know this in all sorts of ways. She's the author of God's Little Black Dress for Women, How to Put on the Full Armor of God Without Losing Your Femininity, which is a classic in all sorts of ways. I say that even as a male. And of course, a new scenario, which is basically a fifth of the story, an attack on the US soil, and an agent of the CIA, Brock, finds himself in the middle of the mess. Enough of such stuff. We have to actually welcome to the Author of the Week feature the awesome talent that is Dr. Catherine Hutchinson Hayes. How are you, Catherine?
I'm doing really good. How are you, Alex?
I'm good. I mean, it seems like only yesterday that we connected, but here we are, all connected. Now, if we read through your CV, basically we'd spend the next 50 minutes just working through that. So we haven't got time. But actually, in terms of jumping straight in, would you like to share with us a fifth of the story? Is this a whole new area of suspense, action, and various other things that you've decided to explore?
Yeah. Matter of fact, I just got my author copies. I'm so excited. Yeah, to see it actually come to fruition. But this is one of five books in a series. The second book is already written, and it should be published next year. And I am furiously writing the rest of the books in the story. Yeah.
Almost at the same breathless pace at which the actual story is unfolded. It's fantastic. Great stuff.
Yeah. I had a lot of fun writing it. It's something that I never envisioned myself writing before. I thought maybe I was more of a literary fiction kind of person, or more of a nonfiction person. But it was the encouragement of a mentor I had, and also going to a writer's conference. And there was a project that I just toyed with. It was a book of short stories. And there was a publishing expert that went through it and said, there's really something to this. And I especially like this particular story. And I believe you can weave it together. And if you follow what I'm telling you, you will get published. Now, it took a couple of years, but I did. I followed through. I had to really learn the craft of the thriller, the craft of writing a fiction novel, and veering away from my nonfiction background. And she was right. I followed what she explained to me I needed to do. And then I also followed my mentor. His name is Cecil Murphy. He's written a couple hundred books, and he really knows the industry inside out. So a couple of his books became movies, and I decided that I had to take his advice because he definitely knew more than I did.
Which is, I suppose, the best way for the human condition and the ideal. We all need to actually share and appreciate our co-creating work in this adventure we call life. Let's mention some of the awards that you've actually picked up over the years. Of course, the New York Mayor's Contribution to the Arts Award, Outstanding Resident Artist of Arizona, the Foundation's Awards at the Blue Ridge Mountains Christian Writers Conference, three times, of course, 2016, 2019 and 2021. I mean, clearly, we've got to ask the question, how do you fit it all in?
Well, it comes from my administrative background. I spent many years as a principal. I think it was a principal longer than I was even a teacher, but it taught me how to master your schedule. And for writers, I don't know that we ever master our schedules. There's always something to do. But it taught me the art of planning for the entire year. So there are things like a blog I take really seriously. I have a team of other bloggers. It's 9 of us. I plan our calendar a year in advance, so everyone knows when they're writing, what they're writing about. And I also try to plan my podcast. I run a podcast. I try to plan that out. I try to have 4 to 6 months of material before I run out. Last year, I had a year's worth of material just 4 months into the podcast, which is another problem, but a good problem to have. So it's about creating balance. It's about I one thing that's bad is I go to bed way too late and I wake up way too early. It's just not a good mix. I don't recommend it. I'm trying to figure that out. But it's about scheduling. It's about prioritizing. You can't do everything all the time at once and be good at anything. So it's just honing your skills and really mastering trying to have excellence in some specific and key areas of your life.
We mentioned at the start, of course, in America, this is Black History Month and so on. Is that something which, again, you feel it? I mean, obviously, it is important, but in many ways, do we also need to just celebrate the creativeness, the diversity, across the year, not just for 28 days, 29 days, or however many days the month happens to have?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And it's constantly something that's debatable. People talk about it all the time. But the issue is, would we, if we didn't have, would we really consistently do that if we didn't have a month to specifically celebrate the accomplishments of people who are Black or Black and Brown people? And I think why it became something that we needed to specifically celebrate is because so many of the achievements of African Americans here in the United States went unnoticed. There's so many things. And so I love your thinking, Alex. When I was a school teacher, it's something I was really intentional about. I was intentional about first of all discovering the ethnicities of my students and making sure that we celebrated each one in a subtle way. I didn't make it I had a young lady who was a refugee from Afghanistan. Another family, they were from Vietnam. I'm just thinking about some of my diverse classrooms. One young lady, she was really torn because her family was from Pakistan, and she was getting to the age where she had to wear her I forget, I think it's a jihad.
Hijab,
Hijab.
I think.
Okay, thank you. And just educating our students about what that means to her culturally, breaking it down, just so we prepared the students and she felt included. So it's about educating people, not just about African Americans, but about what we all contribute to our country and to the world.
Indeed, that infinite diversity in infinite combinations, to use the classic Gene Roddenberry line from the 1960s. Maybe 60 years later, we're still learning, and we'll continue to need to learn that. One of our fine souls, who in a few weeks' time will be hosting a program from the Lincolnshire Agricultural Society's Epic Centre for International Women's Day on March the 8th, of course, is Anna Koskinel from, of course, the joys of Romania and Bucharest. Anna, any questions you have for Catherine?
I actually have lots of questions, but I'm gonna start with two that I'm most intrigued about. You said in the beginning that you made this shift fiction quite recently, and I wanted to ask you what made you make this change and why are you writing fiction now?
Because it blends in my creative side. I'm really creative, that I've always thought that way. I'm a musician, I'm an artist, and so it was just I didn't realize how freeing it was. I felt free to let my imagination run wild. I do like things to be realistic, so I do extensive research. I research just as much as I write, because in order for things to be realistic to your readers, I feel like I owe them that. So the shift was organic. I did what I knew at first. I came out of academia. I wrote for journals. I was a columnist for a magazine, even when I was a principal. And I knew that, but it was taking that leap of faith and doing something new. But it really connected with that creative side that I had, where I couldn't be as creative with nonfiction. And this was just such a wonderful outlet.
I see. And this brings me to my next question, which is if you feel like fiction and what you're writing now allows you to express more of your deeper emotions other than other genres in which you wrote or journals or other work you have published?
And don't get me wrong, I enjoy both. I write for a number of publications. I enjoy that immensely, and I write for a column for editors, for other for Christian writers. I enjoy that because I get to talk about the craft, and I get to talk. I can't be authentic. I can talk about the struggles, the rejection, how you feel when your project is rejected, or you struggle with something that's dear to you. But yes, the fiction side of it lends to being very creative. I think that in fiction, there's always an element of who we are. We if I think if you knew me personally and you read my book, you would get to you would pick up a lot of things. And I am having friends who are reading my book and they're saying, "Oh my goodness, is this such and such? Is this, are you talking about this part of the family?" And I'm like, "Yes, you got it." So there's me in there, right? So it's a way to really be free, and you work through your characters, and you have these what ifs. Like the sequel to this book is called By the Zeal of Fire, unless a publisher has me change the title. And it's about a young woman who goes blind. And I felt like I was becoming this lady. I was trying to go through parts of my house, not, closing my eyes, trying to put myself in her shoes. And so I believe, Anna, that it really does allow you to be so creative. You live through your characters.
There is, of course, the suggestion that there's no such thing as fiction in the universe, that our fiction is somebody else's reality, and we're simply uttering the words that another writer might be writing for us, which is quite mind-blowing in all sorts of ways.
Yeah,
Let's
true.
briefly address your podcast, Murder, Mystery, and Mayhem Laced with Morality. I think we've talked about this before, but I just love the title in terms of the way we've actually got that, because normally, perhaps one doesn't necessarily see murder and mystery and mayhem being laced with morality. So why the title, Catherine?
Yeah, well, it helps me feel that there's hope. So even if I write dark stuff, and I have to admit, I'm not really a chick flick kind of a girl. I am the shoot 'em up, bang bang, action packed kind of a girl. And so what this podcast does, it allows me to feature authors who write all those things: true crime, mystery, cozy mysteries, things that are dark. But I always like it to come back to hope. Even if we write about the dark, even if we are writing stories that are tough to swallow, how do we turn it back around, and how do we give hope to a broken and very sad world? And I just love adding that element to each podcast, even if it's not specifically asked, because sometimes I ask them, like, how do you infuse morality into what you write, as dark as what you write is? And I love that authors always come up with something. I think many of us, no matter what we write, we're searching for hope. We're searching for healing.
I recently came across a series of stories which were entitled Christian Tales from the Twilight Zone, and a kind of look at that, and obviously using the motif that Rod Serling, of course, used so effectively back in the original Twilight Zone television series, having the sort of twist in the tale, but again with a Christian edge. So again, it's interesting to do that, and belief systems in general can be quite fascinating. I mean, if one has a strong, passionate belief in the fact that we are here for a reason, that there is a spiritual force, a guidance, a guiding light that effectively will say that, we need to listen to that inner voice, that we have that inner check system of checks and balances, the good voice, the negative voice, etc., which seems to be a common human experience, no matter whether you're coming from a Christian, Islamic, or indeed Buddhist background from that point of view. Do you feel sometimes maybe we have a lot of challenges in our life because we don't listen to our inner voice, or we don't actually acknowledge the fact that, we are players on the stage, but at the same time, we need to embrace the fact that we're also fallible human beings as well?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, we do need to embrace that. And I think a lot of us, and I feel like my characters in my books, we're searching for meaning. We're searching for purpose. We want to know that our lives count for something, that we matter. And when we infuse everything that we write with that hope, I think people are drawn to it and it gives people encouragement. I really love that you brought that out.
Anna, back to you.
I was just thinking of what you were saying and about the podcast and about life in general, and our fiction is someone else's reality. And I think through your podcast, you have such a wonderful chance of talking to everyone and expressing your reality and making them feel heard and understood. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think when you started this podcast, what was your biggest challenge and what you hope to achieve the most from it?
Yeah. So my biggest challenge was getting guests onto the podcast because nobody knew me. They weren't sure what it was all about. And so that was a challenge to get people to be recorded and then to get listeners. Because there's so much competition, and there's so many great podcasts out there. And so those were two of the main challenges. And so what happened is I advertised this at writers' conferences, specifically Killer Nashville, which is in Nashville, Tennessee, and here in the States. And it was great because I found a niche. I was with people, that's what they wrote. They wanted to be featured. And so it really took off from there. After that, I was really consistent about getting the podcast out. And so making sure that it's streamed on all your major platforms, and also making sure that I promoted it through all of my social media outlets. I just relentlessly promoted it. And what happened is it was picked up by a publishing house, and I was able to, well, I didn't know this at the time, but the head, the CEO of the publishing company, contracted for all of his writers to get on the podcast. And then I got the attention of several publicists, and they were sending me their entire client list. And so in the second year of the podcast, it exploded. And like I said, I had so many guests lined up. I was going into double booking. So I would, instead of producing one podcast on Sundays, I was doing two because I had so many clients. And I didn't want them recording one year and their episode coming out the following year. So those are such great questions. And I hope anyone who's listening to this and thinking about a podcast, that they go for it. Because you have your own story to tell, no matter who has what out there. We are unique. And we have something specific to offer that nobody else can do because we're us.
I do believe that it's an amazing way of even journaling, having a podcast and talking about your experiences to the world and sharing your beliefs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anthony Avena, US reviewer, said the following about one of your classic works, Catherine. The attention to detail the author gives to this book in regards to the biblical verses and the way the author was able to find ways of incorporating femininity and female empowerment into the lessons that each chapter taught were great to see. We're, of course, referring to God's Little Black Dress for Women, How to Put on the Full Armor of God Without Losing Your Femininity. As we mentioned, we're coming up to obviously International Women's Day on March the 8th, something we share across the world, obviously. Share with us your thoughts on that particular routine. I mean, I'm always familiar with Coco Chanel's Little Black Dress. Don't really suit it myself, but then again, it's I step away from that line.
Yeah, that book came about because I am a Christian by faith, and I had a near-death experience. I almost died from a brain hemorrhage. I had a brain hemorrhage, and I had meningitis 16 years ago when I had my third child. I was not expected to live, And while I was in the hospital recuperating or dying, I wasn't sure what was happening. I thought about what I would do if I got out of the hospital and if I lived. And I survived. It was, they still don't understand how I survived it because I do now live with a secondary aneurysm. So here I am, I come out of the hospital, a walking miracle, and I just couldn't get rid of that thought, those thoughts I had while I was in the hospital. I couldn't watch TV. I had to be in the dark. My room had to be set in the 50s because of traumatic brain injuries. You're just always hot. And I thought, okay, I really have to act on what I was thinking about because this near-death experience, I survived it, but it revealed to me I'm not going to be here forever. That's just a fact of the matter. I mean, I think death has 100% win, right? The odds of dying are 100%. And so I thought, when I leave, I want something tangible to leave for my children, my daughters. I only have daughters. And I thought, how can I share my faith in a way that they could get it? And I went to fashion. I made it fun. I love Coco Chanel. I love her story. She's similar to me as Esther in the Bible. If any of you ever read the Bible, you would know that Esther was just the ultimate feminist. I mean, she just
And she was badly done to, let's face it. I mean, she had a lot of trouble, but I mean, there were people who were actually calling her out for all sorts of reasons until finally someone actually said, I think you'll find that wrong.
Right, yeah. She was pretty. She was like one in one of the first like beauty pageants. I mean, they had a whole pageant to find her. And so in the book, I look at how women excelled in the Bible and how using Christian principles, you can be strong, but you can be a girl, you can be up your finest self as a woman. And what does it mean to be a woman? And in it, I share stories about myself, my struggles. I share stories about characters in the Bible. But more than anything, I share clips from iconic designers like Coco Chanel and things that they said and how it relates to how women think, how our beauty in the exterior is just as important to what's going on inside. No matter how old we get, no matter how young we are, there's something about us women where we just want to radiate. We just want to be noticed. We want to be appreciated. And we do a lot to get there.
And of course, as we know, the devil wears Prada, so clearly you don't want to actually go down that line, but still. Anyway, Anna again.
You're such an inspiration with the way you're talking about your life and about your experiences. And to be honest, the only certainty we have in life is that we're going to die. And wanting to leave something behind is, I think, the only thing that helps us sometimes get through the day and just push forward to be able to, in the end, say we made it. I made this. People will remember me by this. And I think for me, for example, seeing you doing this and being able to achieve so many things is just one of the main reference points in which I can say that, okay, there are people out there that are able to do this and they are doing it. So if they can, I can try to do it as well and succeed. And it's beautiful that you have so much to give to the world, and not only by what you're doing, but by the way you're doing it and talking about it and sharing about it. And your daughters are really lucky to have a mother like you. And I feel like the world is a better place with people like you in.
Oh, that's so kind. Wow. I wish I could just have this on a recording and just play out for my daughters.
Well, you can, Catherine, because it will be available as a podcast in the very near future, so you can play it as often as you wish.
I love it. Yeah, this is good.
One of the questions we often put to authors is musical soundtracks. Do you actually use any music in the background to either inspire or to accompany your writing, either with lyrics, without lyrics, and so on? Are there any thoughts that you have with respect to that, or do you prefer to write in absolute silence?
Yeah. So for my not and thank you, that's a great question because I love music. And so I play music all day. I have a very eclectic taste in music. I was trained as a classical pianist, so I love the classics. I love orchestra music, I love opera. But there's also some I love Christian rap. I love dance music. I love Afrobeat. My family is Caribbean, and so I absolutely love reggae and salsa, and I love soca and calypso. And so I do write to this guy. His name is Gregory Porter. He's a jazz artist, and he's an incredible voice and an incredible band and a great story of survival, if anybody's is into that. And so the book, A Fifth of the Story, just called for Gregory Porter. I wrote that whole book to everything he sings. And my other book, the second one in the series, called for like neo soul. It just wanted neo soul and lots of instrumental jazz. And so I listened to what the book wants. Now, if I'm writing nonfiction, I like Bob Marley. I like classics. I like to listen to lots of orchestra and Christian. It depends if I'm writing a Christian piece. I like to listen to Christian songs. So great question and a fun question. Yeah.
Well, again, and given the choice between some Bob Marley or Gregory Porter, where would you go? Or is that just an impossible choice?
That's an impossible choice. It's just that there's no choosing. It's hard. Yeah.
Oh, we may have to feature both in a back to back at the end of this little piece for the listener, which is always good. What advice would you give to the young Catherine Hutchinson Hayes? You know, the 12-year-old Catherine Hutchinson Hayes, who basically maybe a little bit uncertain about her path in life, where things are going, etc. What would you, from your current perspective, say, this is what you should do, girl?
Yeah, that's hilarious because at 12, I just thought I had my whole life planned out. I knew I was going to become a doctor. I always wanted to be in the medical field. And by some fluke in college, I ended up shifting gears. So I would tell the young Catherine to not get discouraged. And even if your path that you laid out for your life and you thought was going to go perfectly, even if it doesn't go how you planned, still have fun in the ride. Still know that you're going to get to where you're supposed to be, and to relax and enjoy the ride.
It's been awesome sharing some thoughts and very, very inspirational. I'm sure Anna will agree. But we need to obviously continue promoting A Fifth of the Story. I mean, again, the other four fifths will come through, no doubt. As you said, you're already writing the next one from that perspective. In terms of that, given that this is obviously the whole notion of a character who has fought for freedom as a CIA agent during one of US history's darkest hours. Do you feel we have cause to be optimistic? Because sometimes one looks around at the global situation, and you—I mean, we've lost Alexei Navalny recently, somebody who I was a big fan of, and again, a tragedy from that point of view. We have the tragedy of Gaza, the issues relating to that, of course. Do you feel sometimes we actually say, "Look, we need to keep that optimism. It's so important, even more now, to keep the faith, quite literally and metaphorically." And progress through the 21st century.
Yeah, it's a great point. Yeah, and actually, when I was writing this book, there's been always something going on lately, and there are snippets of things that the characters refer to that they're experiencing that are similar to what's happening. Because I've never seen such turmoil in all my life. I'm not the oldest person. I'm not the youngest. It's just shocking. Every day you turn on the news, you hear something more shocking. And it does sometimes feel hopeless, especially when we worry about losing the integrity of intelligence agencies, and that's a lot about what this book is. It talks about are the breaches in our intelligence agencies and our concerns. We saw breaches in our country. I mean, I just cannot get that out of my head when we were sitting here watching January 6th in real time. And I'm just like, I cannot believe that this is America. And what my husband was really concerned about, because that's his background, he's from a DIA background, which is like the military branch of the CIA. His concern at the time was, what message are we sending to the world about our national security? Who else is there? He's always thinking from a security standpoint. He's like, we don't know what people who are enemies are there and looking to see the weaknesses in the United States. So globally, I just feel like we're in trouble. I mean, yes, Gaza is horrific. Things going on in South, there are horrible things going on in South America, the continent of Africa. There are a lot of hard things that are happening. And it is important for us to go back to hope and morality, to think, how can I offer something to other people? How can I help people live another day by doing so? And I tried to do that in a fifth of the story. We are discussing all the things, many things that are going wrong, but it goes back to this main character, Brock O'Reilly, who is still determined to fight for friendship, to fight for keeping hope alive, and to fight for purpose, and even to fight for your own country. It's very much a patriotic novel where this person is fighting for everything he believed America should and could be.
Indeed, powerful words. I suppose we could actually say the scenario in the 1970s, particularly bleak in Cambodia. Now it's a tourism destination, so we can get around it, and we will clearly from that perspective. Likewise, Vietnam. Catherine, it's been, as I say, terrific connecting with the good self. How can people follow you on the various social media? Do you have your own TikTok channel and such like?
I have a sad TikTok channel. I am working on it. Maybe one day I'll go viral. Who knows? But it's not happening now. But I'm most active on Twitter. Well, formerly Twitter, now X. I'm also very active on Instagram and LinkedIn and Threads and all the rest. But the best way to connect with me is through my website, because it has connections to all those things. And it is simply www. Dr. Catherine, Katherine Hayes, HAYES.com. Very simple.
And before we have some Gregory Porter, two final questions. Anna, would you like to ask the first one?
Have you had a reasonably enjoyable Zoom out with us?
Yes, this has been a fantastic experience. It feels great to connect with you both.
And therefore, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the not too distant future? Will you be kind enough to return?
I would love that. It would be my honor.
Dr. Catherine Hutchison Hayes, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
You.
I won't die, won't bury, won't sink, 'cause love is the spirit I drink. I'll be free in the morning light, 'cause your touch is the medicine of life. There's a dance to this beat, let's shake. Every move till my body awake. There's a sound, you and me are one, and the home is the rhythm I drum. Is your soul in the desert? Your dreams in the sand. Can't dance with the devil till he's off your back. 'Cause these dry, dry bones gonna rise up, 'cause these dry, dry bones gonna rise up, 'cause these dry, dry bones gonna rise up, 'cause these dry. Till he's off your back. 'Cause he's dry, dry.
Motown, oh, those wonderful magic nights, those great sounds and so on. Detroit, Michigan, of course, famous for a whole variety of things. And we're delighted to be able to welcome to the program today, bassist, producer, and indeed musical director from Detroit, Michigan. It's the legendary Kern Brantley. How are you, Kern?
Oh, great, great, great. Today is great.
Excellent. Well, it's fantastic to connect with your good self. You've got an interesting list, having worked with Beyonce, Lady Gaga, Boyz II Men, Puff Daddy, and Nicole Scherzinger. So quite an interesting range there. All have benefited, doubtless, from your quality.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Thanks.
So what is it, Kern, in particular about Detroit that literally half a century later, we're still talking about it? We still say, that's the magic. That's a really terrific sound.
Well, your point exactly. That's the magic. Detroit has always been a great melting pot. It's in the Midwest, and it's not East Coast or West Coast, but we're kind of in the middle. So we're influenced by the South, the East, and the West as far as our sound. Motown and what Berry Gordy did is that he helped cultivate a sound, and he went and picked the best musicians and singers in the city, and that's how they created Motown. But and plus it's a heavy gospel town. There's a lot of churches there, so we have a heavy influence on gospel music as well. So that was kind of created the sound, and also as well as rock and roll. A lot of Alice Cooper is from Detroit, so there's a lot of great rock history coming out of that city.
I mean, it's more than just the automobile industry, obviously. I mean, I was thinking, is it something to do with the cars that kind of give it that kind of rhythm and natural sense of joy?
Yeah, kind of rhythm and that assembly line process that Berry Gordy used as far as creating a star from the beginning and coming out as a shining new car.
Now, clearly, one of the reasons we're doing this interview is to talk about how Detroit should very much be on people's bucket list for the visitors and so on. And of course, there is the Motown Museum. So would you like to share with us, does that do justice? Does it even begin to do justice to the huge range of talent that the city's produced?
Oh, most definitely. I'm the musical director now at the Motown Museum, and I'm also a mentor there for the summer camp. And we're also in the process of doing an expansion. So they're keeping the original four houses, where they're going to be adding a theater, more restaurants, two recording studios will be there. They're going to have a cafe, which is going to be the Hitsville Cafe, and a beautiful landscape and plaza that they're putting right in front of the Motown Museum. So they're expanding, and the musician, we have a thing called Motown Amplified, where we're bringing out new artists and producing new artists, and also spoken word Motown Mic, where we're introducing spoken word artists as well.
In an era where we are told regularly that artificial intelligence has taken over everything, and see a ChatGPT is actually there, do you feel there's something that's unique and magical about that musical experience that really only real life human beings can produce?
Oh yeah, most definitely. You have to be real. I use AI a little bit, but it's nothing like the organic process. And the thing about music is organic, because we play off of each other. As a bass player at Motown, we have this thing called Detroit Bass Day, which happens every August, where 250 bass players gather. So everybody kind of vibe off of each other. I listen to the drummer, I listen to the strings and the horns. So that's the great part about being organic. You can play and get a vibe between the musicians. That chemistry is the magic.
We're in the midst of the awards season, of course. We've had the BAFTAs on this side of the pond, coming up the Academy Awards, of course. We've had the Grammys. Do you have any favorites? Is there time where you think, yeah, I always prefer the Academy Awards as opposed to the Grammys, or is it just a case of whatever?
I like the Grammys a lot because it's a musical thing. But I've also played at the Oscars once with Lady Gaga, and that was a great experience. Just being there in that room.
And I see that you've also actually got credits with Aretha Franklin, Mary J. Blige, and that very magical Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Will Smith. Any particular lines that you've got from that perspective you'd like to share with us?
Oh yeah, well Will Smith, he was so funny in the studio. I played on a bass song, Get Jiggy With It. I did that album with him as well as LL Cool J's album. So I had a great time in the studio with him. He's a comedian. Like he had us laughing through the whole session. My experience with Mrs. Franklin was very unique because I was hired to play bass on her gospel album, and I was in the studio working with her. And I had a question for her, and I said, "Excuse me, Aretha, what notes are you playing?" And she was like, "It's Mrs. Franklin." So she demanded her respect. She is definitely the queen.
Yeah,
So,
that's all good. I must admit, when you said getting jiggy with it, I think that's one of my two favorite Will Smith numbers. The other one being his rap for Men in Black. I think that was a classic as well, really. But so it goes. Okay, let's go back to the Motown Museum. People listening to this particular item on Siren Radio in cold, miserable England and so on. Why should they actually book tickets now to actually head to Detroit and see the Motown Museum?
Oh yeah, they need to get the tickets now because we have so many great events coming up this summer. Like I say, the Motown Bass Day is coming up, and we have Amplified. Then we have a thing they have Founders Day, which is a tribute to Berry Gordy's sister Esther Gordy. And then there's so many different programs going on at Motown. Every day is very active. You get to come into see the original studio, the original offices, the wardrobe, photos. There's a photo there of the Supremes and Diana Ross with the Queen of England. And it's great. And Michael Jackson's glove and his fedora hat is actually there on display.
Yeah, just the one glove for Michael, as we know. He wouldn't actually have a second one. So probably couldn't afford it, that's all. He probably needed to sell a few more records to actually have two gloves. Just had one glove for himself. Never mind. Who were your own influences, Kern, in terms of as you were growing up? Who kind of really stood out in terms of, yeah, this is what led me to a career in the music industry?
Well, there's a guy from Detroit. His name is Greg Phillinganes, and he's from Detroit. And he was the musical director for Quincy Jones, Michael Jackson, Stevie Wonder. He plays in the band Toto, and he also worked closely with Eric Clapton. He was a guy that I looked up to growing up, and I was like, "Wow, Greg is playing with Michael Jackson and Stevie. Maybe I aspire to be like him." As well as James Jamerson, who was the bass player for Motown Funk Brothers.
Yes, I was listening to some Toto recently, the soundtrack for the David Lynch movie Dune, which I think is still very underestimated in terms of the quality that comes through on that. Okay, web addresses, Kern. How can people actually find out more details about Detroit, Michigan, and indeed the Motown Museum online? Where would you point them?
Oh, take to visitdetroit.com for sure. That's the place they'll have everything there that you need as far as the cruise ships. We also have Third Man Records, which is Jack White from the White Stripes. That's there in Detroit. We have Baker's Keyboard Lounge, which is a famous jazz club, one of the oldest jazz clubs in the world. And we also have the Aretha Franklin Amphitheater that is right there on the coastline of Canada and Detroit. So you can actually see downtown Windsor from the theater.
You see, we do a regular feature from New York, which is called New York Real Talk. Clearly, we need to actually set up a Detroit link as well from that point of
Oh,
view to actually
yes.
work our way through that. So, we need to go move a bit further north, really. The New Yorkers have had a fine time, and likewise, obviously, Los Angeles, etc. But Detroit is clearly where it is at in more ways than one. Kern, are you on the social media? Can people follow you as well?
Yeah, sure. I'm on the Instagram at Kern Brantley, and also I'm on Facebook under Kern Brantley, and I have my own website, kernbrantleymusic.com.
Fantastic. Well, Kern, it's been awesome connecting with your good self today. Two final questions. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today? Has it been okay for you?
Oh, yeah, this is wonderful. I really appreciate it too. This is great. I
All
love
right.
it.
Well, then the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you when you're back in Detroit and maybe connecting with you again? Would you be happy to join us and do another little connection on your magical musical tours and stories? Will you come back to us?
Oh, yes, definitely. Most definitely. Yes, sir.
Conan Bradley, legendary record producer. You must be heading towards the Hall of Fame. I'm sure that must be happening. I mean, it'll be there. It has to go there. But for the moment, Conan Bradley, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and keep on producing.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it.
A sad fact that recent research has indicated that the gap between the genders when it comes to health is as great as it's ever been. This is something we looked at, of course, last year, and it still seems that women's health is not being taken seriously. So to address some of these findings and to really shine a spotlight, quite rightly, on this totally abhorrent situation. We're delighted to welcome GP for Women's Health at Benenden Hospital. That's Dr. Fiona Warner. How are you, Dr. Fiona?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Excellent. And we've also got TV presenter and Women's Health advocate, Sherry Healy. How are you, Sherry?
Very well, thank you so much.
Good. Well, we're all well, which is fine, so that's okay.
Are you well?
Indeed. I think we had one or two challenges with respect to our Zoom connection, but other than that, all's well with the world. However, this finding, 42% of women are uncomfortable discussing their health issues with their manager, 35%, so over a third, are avoiding going to the doctors for reasons including anxiety and embarrassment, and 60% of women in the UK believe that their health issues are not taken seriously. I mean, those are just the headline findings from this particular survey. I mean, Fiona, if we can come to you first, were you surprised that we're still in this situation as we're approaching the second quarter of the 21st century?
I think it is really sad, the statistics that that we now have from this research that Benenden Health have done. I think this is a problem that's been around for very many years. It's historically there's there's always been a significant gender health gap, but why we can't seem to change this, and what we need to do to look into how we can change this is what we really want to do with this research, and try and find, learn more about women's experiences and try and understand so that we can put things in place to change this.
Mm. I mean, Sherry, from your own experience, why is women's health not cared for in the same way as men's? I mean, we heard a great deal about stiff upper lip and how it's men's troubles, etc. But it does seem as though, you know, there are key challenges here.
Absolutely. I mean, it's historical. So the NHS was created by men for men. And for a long time, women weren't even included in the medical research because we're cyclical, we ruin results, we're inconsistent. And so medication isn't always tailored specifically to us. So there is historical problems there. But also, the Benenden Health Research showed that 72% of women don't even believe that the health gap exists. So this part of this campaign is educating women and men and empowering women to say, okay, so I haven't been believed, or I feel like my symptoms haven't been taken seriously. This might be part of this problem. And so I can go and ask for a second opinion. I can make a bit more noise. I can make my voice louder to be heard. I mean, I was staggered to read that the UK has the largest female health gap in the G20 countries and the 12th largest globally. So it is a big problem, but there are things that can be done to fix it. So, for example, Benenden Health has a 24/7 GP service. They also allow women to choose female health professionals if that's what they prefer, because some women don't want to go to the GP because they are embarrassed. If it's a gynecological problem, they might not want to talk about it. So there are things that can be done to make a positive change, but at the moment, the gap is just too big.
Mm. Fiona, turning to yourself for the moment, what needs to change actually in the medical field when it comes to equality of treatment, and not just opportunity, but treatment when it comes to both men and women?
So I think first and foremost, there needs to be awareness that this exists. I think all medical professionals need to understand that and understand, you know, the statistic that 60% of women feel that they're not being heard or not being taken seriously. You know, that's probably one of the first and easiest things to address by making sure that people are aware of their biases and making sure that that's addressed. I think we need more research into women's health. There's very little funding at the moment in women's health. And as Cherry was saying, you know, historically, women have not been used in clinical trials. There's just been an assumption that medications and drug doses should be the same for men and women. And often that's not right. Women often suffer more side effects.
Weren't women considered just to be small men?
Yes. Yes. So,
and we're really not, are we? We're made up very differently.
We're absolutely not. there are so many areas, and also just education, as Cherry was saying, just educating women as well so that they're informed, that they have awareness. There's lots of information that we provide. Benenden Health has an excellent women's health hub, and there's information on the website, but more information also in schools, and just making sure women feel empowered, that they're able to research themselves and be able and not to feel afraid or embarrassed to go and talk to a doctor.
Mm. You mentioned, of course, bias there. I mean, that's conscious. Is there any possibility that unconscious bias could actually be creeping in as well, that kind of we've become inured to this whole notion that we don't even realise, or society doesn't realise, that actually these biases are occurring?
Absolutely. And you know, the default model, certainly when you're training to be a doctor or any health professional, the default model tends to be a man. And it female biology just isn't understood as well as male biology. So you do have those biases just from the education that we've had and our training that we've had. And that's why I think this awareness is so important. To be aware of that, to be able to reflect on that, is essential, really. And possibly retraining, you know, making sure that women's health is given greater priority in our standard training.
Returning to the wider society, Cherry, in the workplace, is there more that employers can actually do to effectively address this imbalance?
Yeah, absolutely. So in part of this research done by Benetton Health, they asked women what they would like to, you know, how they would like improvements to be seen. And for some women said they would like pregnancy loss days. And I think that's really important. That's a really sensitive subject. It's a really difficult thing to talk about. So to have leave, if you've experienced something really traumatic like that, would make a huge difference. I think for managers to be aware of menopause and perimenopause, the symptoms around it, to have compassion, to have somewhere that a woman can take a step away if she's experiencing particularly acute symptoms. Knowledge is power. And I think if women feel that the workplace is somewhere they can say, I'm experiencing these things without not being thought of as a great worker. And, you know, there's a lot of ageism here as well, because I think women don't want to talk about the menopause because they don't want to be thought of as like over the hill. Who wants to be thought of as over the hill? No one. We want to be under the hill, do we? No, we don't. But so, you know, being open about these conversations, making sure that people who are running these companies understand what menopause is. It doesn't mean the end of things. It just is a moment in time when your body changes, and a little bit of support goes a really long way.
Well, let's hope that when I actually speak, we can actually see improvements being made across the base. Fiona, best place to go to find out further details about this research and indeed Benenden?
You can go to Benenden Health's website. There's a great deal of information on there. As we said, there's a Women's Health Hub and lots more information about all the services that are offered for women.
Fantastic. Dr. Fiona Warner, GP for Women's Health at Benenden Hospital. And Cherry Healy, TV presenter extraordinaire, of course, and Women's Health Advocate. Huge thanks. And stay healthy and be well.
We will indeed.
Thank you very much. You too.